to Ian Dunt in the United Kingdom to give us the latest on what's happening over there. Ian, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Ian, what now for Count Binface?
Yeah, well, I mean, I suspect more of the same, although possibly with sturdier competition from the Conservatives, Labour and Lib Dems, because he will keep on doing what he does, which is, you know, as an emissary of his home planet, and running in by-elections and trying to be a sort of mocking, and I have to say, to give him full credit, dryly witty, as he has been so far. So there will, I mean, there's a pretty good chance, a very good chance, really, that there's going to be another by-election at some point in Clacton, and he will run in that. The only difference is that this time there will be other parties running too.
Did Clacton in the end humiliate Farage, or did he manage to get through?
I think humiliate's quite strong. It's been bad for him. Like, I mean, we look, none of us, it is the most right-wing seat in the country. Like, quite literally, it is the seat that votes right most heavily in the country. So none of us were expecting him to lose. But we were looking for things like vote share, turnout, as signs that people were getting tired of him. We have not seen that. So there was actually, I mean, the turnout was perfectly respectable for a by-election. His vote share actually marginally improved in Clacton. However, I sort of think that that's the wrong question. That's a question that concerns the battle and not the war. Because if you look at what's been happening to his reputation outside of Clacton, which needless to say is much less right-wing, it has been poor. So BMG research poll saw a 10-point collapse over the campaign in his approval ratings, down to minus 49%.
Whoa.
More in Common had a 10-point collapse as well, down to minus 32%. He is now, by some distance, the least popular politician in Britain, leader in Britain, but partly, I admit, because Keir Starmer used to get worse numbers than this, but he's gone now. So it hasn't done him any good in the country. In Clacton, I mean, it's not like, you know, it wasn't a humiliation for him. But what's his game, really? Like, he spent the beginning of this year trying to adopt fairly moderate positions, you know, for him. So slightly to the right of Genghis Khan, but slightly to the left of where most of his party members are, in an effort to appear as prime ministerial as possible, to try and peel off those sort of conservative voters in the shires who don't like people who look like they want to start street violence. They don't like the sound of racial, you know, rhetoric. But, you know, they're fundamentally right-wing voters. He needs to do that. But what is he now? Now he doesn't look prime ministerial. Now he looks like someone who spends the summer arguing with a bin, who's holding one by-election in his constituency to get over accusations of financial misconduct, who is then going to face what we can presume to be a very critical parliamentary investigation, and then have another by-election in his constituency over financial misconduct. I mean, he is in a bad place. Is it a humiliation? Possibly not. But you wouldn't want to be him.
Yes, yes. And has this been an occasion for people to look at the new prime minister, or has the focus been so much on the rubbish bin and Farage that what's happening in Westminster hardly counts?
Now, you know what? Actually, Farage didn't really get the coverage, and this is what he wanted. Like, he's really good. It's incredible. It's a very base thing to understand, but he was the one that got it. That the summer months, when everyone's on holiday, the MPs are all on holiday, loads of the journalists are, is a real news desert. And you can own a full month of the news calendar by just creating news in that period. And that's what he tried to do with this absolute nonsense about, I'm a man, you know, fighting the establishment in a by-election, rather than just a bloke trying to get away from stories about 5 million quid that ended up in my bank account. He failed to do it, really, because there was no contest there, apart from the Count Binface element, which, you know, can only get so much coverage. So there actually wasn't that much coverage of him. And Burnham has done a good job in a very new and different, quite fresh way of securing attention. So we have constant announcements. I mean, fairly modest announcements, a lot of them, but all quite helpful, you know, reducing bus prices, reducing business rates on pubs, getting rid of limitations on when disabled people can use their bus passes. You know, smart, good cost of living stuff. He's spread it using some traditional media. He is doing some BBC, some ITV, but predominantly by doing podcasts and, you know, Instagram accounts, you know, appearing with 20-year-old influencers in a way that,
yeah.
I mean, it's a little bit cringy, but it's not, you won't break your back cringing at it. And it seems to have been pretty effective. So to give you an example, I was having dinner with my parents on Friday night when a news alert came on about wildfires. And because my mum is in her early 70s, she got instant messages and text messages from all of her friends who are basically women in their 70s, many of whom are conservative voters. And as I was looking at them, three of them referred to Andy Burnham just by his first name. They just said, oh, Andy sent a message. And I thought, oh, that's quite interesting. Like the fact that you've got people who aren't even that naturally disposed referring to the prime minister by his first name, something that I haven't seen since Boris Johnson, indicates that his approach towards communication is having some impact. He's seen as quite friendly, you know, someone that you wouldn't mind having a drink with, someone who's not ideological, who's probably a bit on your side. As far as a prime ministerial start goes, it's been a long time since I've seen someone make a better one.
After being sacked from Cambridge, a young black academic, Jason Ardern, took his own life. What's the reflection on that in Britain at the moment?
It's quite sort of weirdly traumatized, actually. I mean, certainly on the liberal side, and I myself was quite surprised by how upset I was. And some of the thinking that is now happening feels healthy. I'm trying to put my words carefully here because so often with these things, there's a sort of 1 or 2 weeks of taking stock and then things just go back to how they were. But for anyone who's actually thoughtful about this stuff, you get almost a sense of this man who was just sort of, he's deeply, deeply, deeply flawed. And he made up a bunch. He was essentially a fantasist. And that's all there. Okay. So we'll say that. And so are many others. But he was a man who was sort of used by left and right, really. And in fact, I still feel like it's happening now. Like the left, when you look at what Cambridge did when they gave that position, that feels like a usage of someone when it was helpful to have black faces in institutions that otherwise have almost no representation from minority figures.
And not just a black face, a handsome young man with hair down to his waist, et cetera, exotic.
Exactly. And then getting you over so many of the PR problems that you have if you're Cambridge University. You know, like who are you looking for in this period? Someone like that. And probably there was a lack of attention paid to the diligence of the academic work that this was based on, because they were essentially dealing in identity politics. Then you see what the right did. You know, this is a story that sprung, I mean, partly admittedly, because he started libel proceedings against mainstream journalists that tried to cover it. But it was started in the, you know, the grim areas of the far right online. It is then produced, once it was clear that a lot of what he'd said was made up, it produced a volume of coverage that was, it's hard to think of things outside of like royal weddings, you know, that produce that many think pieces. Like, certainly more coverage than anything else that we're talking about today, more coverage than the Clacton by-election, more coverage than the policies that the Prime Minister is putting forward. I mean, you look at how much the Telegraph and the Times are putting out. I'm talking multiple pieces a day, just churning it out. Bear in mind, there is another academic at Cambridge who has been accused of plagiarism, white in this case, by the FT. I don't see him out of it. I don't see dozens and dozens of pieces on him, because the interpretation that the right pushed on this was if a black academic cheats, it means that woke has gone too far, that diversity has gone too far. It's a reflection on an ethnicity and on a culture that worries about an ethnicity. So therefore, that in itself feels like this deeply racist, ugly, venal approach. So he was used by the right. And then, you know, and this is the bit I want to put as carefully as I can, but I feel like it is true. I think something flipped at the moment that he died. And suddenly the story was then claimed again by the liberal left. Of, oh no, you know, you almost got this sense, you could almost see the cogs turning in people's minds. This is something that we can use, actually. This is something that we can kind of damage the right on. Look at what they've done this time. And suddenly the momentum, now all of the stories come out. You get this period of sort of awkward silence from the really vindictive figures who've been piling on against him. And then suddenly a bunch of people go, well, claiming him again and doing, well, look at how, you know, bloodthirsty the right is. At no point in this is there any real sense of what causes this in the first place, which is the treatment of someone in the media glare as a human being. Like remembering that that is an actual human being that is being discussed in this kind of carnival of media frenzied feeding. There's none of that. Instead, it's this bouncing ball that left and right in turn think they can use to further their agenda. And in the wake of that, it just leaves everyone feeling quite uncomfortable and many people looking very grim indeed.
Ian, is it still hot?
As of today, it is less hot. It is now like a sort of normal summer. But, you know, we're dealing with months now and, you know, it remains the most remarkable summer that I've lived through weather-wise.
And trains are falling off their tracks. Now, is that the heat?
Yeah, there's some report here exactly of a bending of the tracks due to the heat. We also, there's drought. I mean, this is our third drought in 5 years. You used to average one every 10 years. There's, as I said to you last time, the way that the country looks, whether it's when you look at photos of, you know, of it shot from above or whether you just leave your house, it just doesn't look like England. It sort of looks like Spain. It's got that kind of starched, dry, reddish, brownish glaze to everything.
Ian, I have to confess that I love looking at those photographs and just, you know, you know, oh, that's Hampstead Heath. It looks like a stretch a little bit west of Bathurst in New South Wales. It's peculiarly pleasing. Hey, did anybody get hurt in that train when the train fell off the tracks?
No, we haven't had any.
It was a terribly, terribly British train crash, wasn't it? It just sort of slithered off the track and fell onto its side. It was beautiful.
It's moderate tea drinking British catastrophe. The thing that's annoying about all this, right, is just that progressives have not grabbed hold of it. Like we can, like it is right there for the taking, right there for the taking. Just to say, can you see what is happening? Can you see how urgent it is that we pursue net zero? And politically, in a more cynical way, it works. Like the environment is now a firm dividing line on the right. Like on the pages of the Telegraph, you know, old, very reactionary English newspaper, mostly read by old generals who are haunted by a history of sexual failure. You know, it's now embroiled in this sort of civil war within its own pages about whether climate change is real and whether something should happen about it. It divides the right. And yet all of the movement, all of the momentum is on the right. It's actually by having people on the right coming out and saying we need to start drilling for gas, for oil, etc. Now, that seems insane to me. It doesn't seem beyond a Labour prime minister or indeed a Dem or a Green leader to say, look at what's happening, driving that wedge within the right, the same way that the right does to the left on cultural issues, and go, why won't these people keep you safe? Richard Tice, the deputy leader of Reform, was out yesterday saying, and I can't believe, you know, astonishing thing to say, don't worry about climate change because it means that we'll get better English wine. And you just think, You shoddy, tiny, minuscule little man. Like, you really are quite pathetic. They are there for the taking on this issue. The public gets it. They get it now, after the last 3 months, more than they've ever got it. And as ever, progressives are failing to pick up the gun and do the damage.
Ian, thank you for joining us once again on Late Night Live.
Thank you very much indeed.
I've been talking to Ian Dunt, columnist with iNews, co-host of the Origin Story podcast.